My name is Dr. Raj Ayyagari, and I'm an associate professor of radiology at Yale School of Medicine. I'm an interventional radiologist, which means I do image-guided, minimally invasive procedures.
You are an interventional radiologist. What does your specialty involve?
We do image-guided, basically minimally invasive surgery. We do procedures pretty much anywhere in the body, from the head to the toe. Things like opening up blood vessels that are abnormally closed down. So if someone has blood clots in their legs, like a DVT, or blood clots in their lungs, a PE, pulmonary embolism, will go in and kind of open the vessels up, suck the clot out. Or sometimes people with chronic peripheral vascular disease will go in and put balloons to dilate them open, or even stents. Another big category of things that we do is we shut down blood flow to things that we don't want to have blood flow. So for example, big tumors in the liver will go in, and it's called embolization. We'll embolize them, cut off the blood flow, and put these little beads in that then send in a drug to kind of help kill the tumors. We do that also in kidney tumors sometimes. Then more in kind of benign realms of women who have fibroids, these benign overgrowths in the uterus, will go in and embolize those to cut off the blood flow to shrink them. Men will get enlarged prostates called BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, and we'll go in and embolize the prostate to shrink that. And we'll do more kind of emergent things, like people come in with bleeding after childbirth or bleeding in the setting of a motorcycle accident, trauma. We'll go in and embolize areas that are bleeding, not just kind of stop life-threatening bleeding. Mm-hmm. And then we also work outside of the blood vessels pretty much everywhere else in the body as well. So people with blockages in their kidneys because of stones or tumors will go in and open things up. All sorts of procedures, pretty much every system everywhere.
Today we're talking about the enlarged prostate and how you treat that with a new microbead procedure. First of all, let's discuss the symptoms of an enlarged prostate. Do you see a lot of guys with enlarged prostates?
I do. It's obviously kind of something I specialize in, so I tend to see a lot of patients with this problem. Basically, BPH, or benign prostatic hyperplasia, is just a benign kind of overgrowth of normal tissue within the prostate that happens over time. The large majority of men in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s will get it. It's just kind of part of the normal process of growing older, unfortunately. But what happens is, over time, there's lots of influences that cause the tissue to grow, but testosterone is one of the big ones. And so the prostate sits like a donut around the urethra at the bottom of the bladder. And as the prostate gets bigger over time, it kind of pinches off the urethra, kind of like squeezing a blood pressure cuff. And then the urine just stops flowing as well as it used to when we're younger. And so the way this can kind of show up is, first kind of like a weak stream and the person having to push hard to get the urine out. It can lead to incomplete emptying of the bladder, which sometimes patients can feel. Sometimes the stream will stop and start. But then also, because that incomplete emptying, sometimes patients will have to urinate much more frequently than normal because they're never actually emptying the bladder properly. And so sometimes they can get up at night many times, even sometimes every hour or more frequently. So it can go from minor annoying problem to a problem that's so bad that a patient stops being able to urinate and we have to put a catheter in them and they have to walk around with a catheter just kind of long term. Also, sometimes more uncommonly, the prostate, when it's really big, gets a lot of blood flow and they can actually start bleeding to the point where it's life-threatening. And so sometimes we'll do procedures literally just to stop the life-threatening bleeding.
The microbead procedure, it's relatively new, isn't it?
Well, not so much anymore. It's been around about 12, 13 years ago. We started doing it in humans. And then it's really been in probably about 10 years or so,
okay,
10 or 11 years. I've been doing it at Yale for 8 years now. But relatively speaking, it is relatively new. Lots of times, surgeries or different procedures will be around for decades. This is just kind of reaching a full decade of kind of common clinical practice where we're getting, starting to get now 10-year outcomes data. So according to who you ask, some people say, well, it's been around for a while. But if you look at kind of, scientific researchers, type of people looking at long-term data, is relatively new.
The microbeads that we're talking about in this procedure, which is called PAE, correct? PAE?
Yeah.
What's in those beads?
So the procedure, it's called prostate artery embolization, and there are lots of different kind of brands and types of agents that we use. What we're doing is we're going into the blood vessel, we're injecting these tiny particles, and the idea is to kind of send in these permanent particles that will just go in and plug up the blood flow and shut down, the blood flow of the gland and starve it of its blood supply so the gland kind of shrinks down and shrivels up like going from a grape to a raisin. And so, there are different kind of products out there.
Okay.
Some people use something called polyvinyl alcohol. It's just a chemical that in a certain form is a solid particle object. Then commonly we'll use the brand name is Embospheres. It's a mixture of a special kind of gelatin, actually, and it's almost like a little plastic bead. They look like grains of sand. And sometimes there's certain circumstances we use these things called coils, where they're actually little platinum fiber. They almost look like the spring that you get in a ballpoint pen, but much smaller. When you kind of pack that in, it's almost like putting a cork in a vessel. Sometimes we have to just kind of close off vessels that way as well. So there's a variety of different agents we use to achieve, you know, what we're trying to do.
This can be an outpatient procedure, right? If there aren't any problems?
And probably 98% of the time it is. We do get some patients who help come into the hospital with severe bleeding, and they'll already be admitted, oftentimes even in the ICU, and we'll do the embolization procedure to stop the bleeding, and they obviously in the hospital. But for patients who are coming in more with the BPH, the symptoms, the urinary obstruction, I would say, you know, 98% of the time it's an outpatient procedure, unless we happen to have three scheduled for a day and then the third patient, you know, it gets done around 8 o'clock and they came from out of state and end up staying just because of more just logistical.
Gotcha. Is the patient put under like a twilight kind of sleep or is it general anesthesia?
Almost never general anesthesia. It's a pretty, because it's such a minimally invasive procedure, there's really minimal discomfort with it, and so we can usually get away with just giving a patient what we call moderate sedation, just some IV medications that kind of make the patient doze off a little bit. It's even less than a patient might get for a colonoscopy typically. And some patients who are really interested in, you know, new technology and really like to see these things, they'll actually ask for no sedation and they'll kind of want to watch the procedure as we're doing it, which is totally fine.
Wow.
Lots of times patients, elderly patients in their 80s and 90s, it can be really quite dangerous to give them any kind of, you know, anesthesia. And so we'll purposely try to minimize the sedation just to kind of, you know, make sure we're doing it safely. And so that's a great draw for the procedure because there are a lot of patients out there who, you know, older patients who have lots of heart disease or lung problems who won't really tolerate general anesthesia very well. Yeah. So this is a great option for them because a lot of the more standard BPH surgical procedures do require heavier levels of, or even general anesthesia.
Where is the incision site and how large is it?
So it's really tiny. First of all, it's not like surgery where you have big incisions and scars and, you know, stitches and all that. Mm. We'll enter the artery either typically in the left wrist or one of the groins called the femoral artery down the groin. And so wherever we go in, we usually make a little hole in the skin, and then we'll put our tube in. It's about as big around as the wire for a phone charger. And so you just feel a little discomfort when we numb the skin up and a little pressure when we put the tube in for about a minute or two, whether it be in the wrist or the groin. But once we get into the artery, you really don't feel much of it after, you know, of the procedure after that. When we're done, we take our little tube out, again, be it the wrist or the groin, and we just have a little, like a tiny little quarter inch or smaller little skin neck, and we just put a small Band-Aid on it. And then we'll usually have you in recovery for a couple hours afterwards just to make sure there are no issues, and then send you home the same day.
Wow. So the beads are inserted in there, and then what do they do?
Not much except to sit there. Basically, we use a lot of our imaging and the very nature of what we do with all imaging guidance. So once we get into the arteries, we'll, in the pelvis where the prostate is, we'll inject some dye like you get for a CAT scan, and it gives us a nice roadmap of all the vessels in the pelvis. And then we literally use that roadmap as a, we overlay it onto our active imaging equipment, and we'll basically be constantly kind of continuously looking as we go and basically steering our little tube into the arteries that feed the prostate. We inject some more dye to confirm that we're in the right spot. Oh. Then we just inject these little beads with a syringe, and the beads just kind of float down into the very, very small arteries in the capillaries of the prostate tissue. They just lodge in there and just plug up. It's like packing marbles in a drain pipe. You just plug up the vessel. Within minutes, you know, the beads kind of settle in and plug up the vessel and shut down the blood flow, and then just kind of sit there. The vessel kind of dies off, basically. So we do that on both sides, typically, and then we take our tube out. And then over time, so like I said, within minutes, the vessels have closed down. And then over time, the tissue, because it started its blood supply, it just shrinks down, and that proves symptoms a lot. Or the bleeding stops if the patient's having bleeding. but the bees just kind of sit there. And so they are kind of permanent. They're inert. We've been using them for decades. So they're very safe. But they'll be there for the rest of the patient's life. They'll take them with them to the grave. They're just kind of like passengers for the rest of the journey.
Do they show up on any x-rays or anything like that, or at the airport when you're going through?
No, the bees themselves are, they're really tiny. They are not opaque. You can't see them on x-ray or MRI or like that, or ultrasound. There are a couple of brands out there that are somewhat more visible, but those are more kind of newer products that are kind of more still in research phase. And I'm not sure how much they really help in this procedure. But so, no, you can't see them. What you're doing is to make sure they're going in the right place when you're putting them in, they're mixed with the dye that we use like for CAT scans. So as we're injecting the bees, they're mixed with the liquid that you can see, so you know kind of where things are going. There are, so I did mention also sometimes we'll put these little coils and little corks to kind of plug up larger vessels. Those are visible on x-ray or CAT scan or MRI. They're really tiny. They don't really cause any problems with imaging, and they won't be detected in airport, metal detectors and like that. But they will show up if you get an x-ray or CAT scan or MRI.
Now, you said it causes a swelling to the prostate to go down, and you described it as shriveling like a grape shrinking into a raisin. That's incredible. Yeah. And over what amount of time does that occur?
So typically weeks to a couple of months. So the first week, as the tissue is dying, the first stage of that tissue death is inflammation. So usually the patients will have pretty significant kind of burning pain in the prostate area for the first week. And because of the swelling in the gland, sometimes their urine symptoms will be worse than they were before, but just for about a week. And usually we can manage that pretty well with anti-inflammatory medications. The second week, things kind of settle down. The patient's symptoms kind of go back to the way they were pre-procedure. And the third week is when patients start to notice the shrinkage happening, and then therefore the urinary symptoms starting to get better. And by the end of the fourth week, most patients are feeling a lot better. We usually tell people about 7 out of 8 patients have a good result. And those patients are usually feeling much of that improvement has occurred by the end of the fourth week.
That's amazing. You must feel very gratified by seeing patients and seeing this happen.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's life-changing. Some people, they'll come in just with catheters in that they're miserable. They've had catheters in for, a year and a half or more. They're getting urinary tract infections. They're getting bleeding. They have this thing sticking out of them, and it's just miserable. And then you treat them, the gland shrinks, they go back to, a reasonable urination pattern again. And they're much happier. Some patients we've had that, I remember a guy, this is before COVID, he had grandchildren in Virginia. We're here in Connecticut. He couldn't really go down to visit them because driving, he would have to stop so frequently. He couldn't stop at the rest stops. There weren't enough rest stops to go. And so he had to choose between either getting a catheter or not, forcing his family to come visit him. So once we helped him out, he got a lot better and was able to kind of have a normal quality of life again. Now, I should emphasize that, we're working with 60, 70, 80-year-old men. And while we can oftentimes make the prostate better and shrink that down and make their urine flow better, your bladder also has to work well for urination to go well. And so we are by no means making people 20 or 30 years old again. So everything else still has to kind of work reasonably well. The bladder has to work. And so it's important to kind of do a lot of testing and evaluation before we go into any kind of procedure to make sure that the problem is still something that we can reasonably improve upon, that a patient's going to get the proper procedure. Because if, for example, sometimes the bladder, it's a muscular bag that squeezes the urine out. And if it's been struggling against blockage from the prostate for decades, the bladder just may be kind of shot and not work well enough. And then we can do whatever we want to fix the prostate, but if the bladder doesn't work, urination doesn't work. And so we have to be, one, careful to make sure we're picking the right patients for any BPH procedure, be it surgery or embolization. But secondly, also to have realistic expectations that, again, we're not going to turn the clock back 50 years. We're just going to hopefully get a patient back to a reasonable urination.
Although I saw on your website that some guys say their sexual function is better. Is that true?
So with any BPH procedure, a lot of the nerves that control erections and the actual ejaculation function pass, around that area. Moreover, the prostate makes a large fraction of the liquid in the semen that comes out. And then there's the actual neurological kind of sensation, of that. anything you do in the prostate can have a negative impact on all those things. And so with surgeries, obviously, they can be more invasive. There can be risk to damaging the nerves to cause erectile dysfunction. And then anything you do to kind of destroy or shrink or whatever prostate tissue, you're going to decrease or even sometimes eliminate the actual liquid of the ejaculation, the semen coming out. With embolization, again, it's less invasive than a lot of the surgeries that are out there. And so we see that the risks of erectile dysfunction are much lower, but nothing's ever zero. So
right. So
with some of these more invasive surgical BPH procedures that are more common, there may be up to a 10% risk of erectile dysfunction because of the nerve damage that can happen. With embolization, we see maybe it's more like 1% or so, maybe 2%, somewhere in that realm. So it's significantly lower, but again, it's not zero. And in terms of the ejaculation volume, again, anything you do to the prostate to kind of destroy it or shut it down, that will change. So we do see lots of patients commonly, I would say, that they notice the semen decreases or goes away. Most people don't really mind that. And if a patient's not in kind of a childbearing phase of their life, which most BPH patients are not, then that's seldom really an issue. We have had reports of patients having improvement in their erectile function afterwards. It's probably, maybe something around 10%. It's hard to really calculate the number because a lot of men in this demographic, in this age range, just aren't sexually active anymore anyway. There are also lots of other things that can kind of improve or worsen erectile function. And so we do see a small but significant number of patients who have improvements. And now we don't know exactly why that is. That has yet to be really determined.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just maybe because we're stopping, because they're doing so well, we're able to stop the BPH medications. And a lot of the BPH medications can have negative impacts on erections and sexual function.
Yeah.
So just by stopping those medications, maybe patients are getting better. I think there are some studies, anything that improves urine flow will sometimes also be, tend to kind of help improve sexual function. And I'm not sure if we really know why that is either. But so it's a very challenging thing to study.
Yeah.
And it's really also in this age group, it's hard to put hard numbers on things. But the overall take home message is that the risk for problems, sexual function problems afterwards is much lower compared to the surgical procedures. And we do see some patients with some improvement, but it's hard to really say.
What would you say about this microbead procedure versus, let's say, TURP or the UroLift procedures?
So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of options out there. And it really depends on a lot of different patient factors that we look at. So, first of all, if your symptoms aren't that bad, then usually the first thing to try is just medications, right? Something least invasive, lowest risk. And for a lot of patients with mild to maybe the lower end of our realm of symptoms, medications do pretty good. Once you're kind of in the upper half of the severity of symptoms, then it's time to talk about a procedure. And then the questions are, are you young and healthy? Are you, relatively speaking, are you able to handle general anesthesia or not?
Mm.
How big is your gland? Lots of the procedures that surgeons do are really a big determining factor of the gland size. So the UroLift, for example, my understanding is that it's really for glands that are on the smaller side. We say 80 milliliters or smaller, whereas a TURP is more, I think, for any size up to about 110, 120, 100, depending on the urologist. Once you get above 120, then your surgical options really kind of drop off. Then you're talking about a prostatectomy, which is just a surgical removal of the gland, which is obviously probably the most invasive option. There's also something out there that's called the HOLEP, H-O-L-E-P, holmium laser nucleation of the prostate. Mm. They go in through the urethra under general anesthesia, and they use a laser to basically shell out the whole gland from, internally. They break it into pieces and then pull the pieces out. All those, definitely, the TURP and the HOLEP are very effective. The TURP is the gold standard. It's been around for decades.
Yeah.
And they have probably unparalleled kind of improvements when you measure things like urine flow. But also you have to look at kind of symptomatology and the risks and, the level of invasiveness. These more invasive procedures will have more impact on sexual function. So for men who are on the younger side or for those who have still have pretty active sex lives, regardless of their age, they might look for something less invasive and less damaging their sexual function. The nice thing about embolization is first of all, you know, if you can't get general anesthesia, that's no problem. If the gland size also doesn't matter. I've embolized glands as small as 50 milliliters or 40 milliliters, all the way up to 750 milliliters, so a huge, almost like a grapefruit size. The symptom improvement that we get from embolization seems to be pretty much in line with the gold standard, which is the TURP. So we can get pretty good symptom improvement with kind of a less invasive route. But also, we don't see the urine flow improves as well as if you just physically go in there and shave out the gland. And so, so there's lots of different ways to measure it. Now, also, you have to look at kind of the long-term data, so 5, 10, 20-year data. And so when you have a TURP done, it's been around long enough that the urologist can give you 10-year and 20-year, you know, rates of recurrence of symptoms and need to reoperate and so on. And with the embolization, we just don't have those data yet. So there's still, we have good 5-year data now, but the 10-year data really not out there yet. The 5-year data look very, very promising, but we also have tough patients. So sometimes patients come in, they're, you know, 65, they're a very healthy 65-year-old. Sure, they may live another 30 years, and we have to tell them that, well, we don't know what it's going to be like 20 years from now. But odds are that things will be good, that the procedure, you know, will really kind of give a lasting effect. And the nice thing, though, about the embolization is that if you don't have a good result or something gets worse later down the line, you haven't burned any bridges. You can still take whatever medications you would otherwise take. You can still undergo any other surgery or procedure that you would otherwise be candidate for, re-embolize a few patients, and also just by shrinking the gland, which usually we shrink by about 30% and cutting off its blood flow, we make those other surgeries safer and easier if they do need to be done. So there's lots of benefits and very, very few side effects to downsides.
Why did you go into this particular specialty?
I started out extra training in urology. I did the first 2 years of training. That was a mix of, you know, the more like kind of bigger, more invasive open surgeries, like for prostate cancer, bladder cancer, but then also a mix of much less invasive, what we call kind of endoscopic procedures, where you put a small scope up through the urethra and go in and do things like removing stones or the TURP or these hole up procedures. And I really much preferred the less invasive procedures. And so I switched out of urology because I thought I really liked all the imaging guided procedures that were out there. And so I went into switched to radiology with this idea to subspecialize in this interventional radiology, which is, you know, like I said, basically image guided minimally invasive surgery. And so I did that, switched into that, did all my training, and then once I came back to Yale for my the job that I've had for now almost over 10 years, because of this experience I've had with kind of urological training, and I knew a lot of the urologists here at Yale, I just kind of started gravitating towards specifically kind of urological, like image-guided, you know, minimally invasive procedures. And so it was kind of a perfect storm of opportunity because I knew people here. There are people who are very collaborative and very interested in kind of newer things. And also at the time, that's when the prostate embolization procedure really started coming into, you know, its own. It turned out to be one of the few things in medicine that come along that work really, really well, very few side effects, very few problems. And it's hard to get clean results in medicine, but so it just kind of, it's great that you came along and I was interested in doing it and I had people who were interested in kind of supporting me with it and it all just kind of came together.
I think you've found your bliss, as they say.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to mention that I may not have asked you about?
We also do other things for the prostate. Now we started doing, so this is for benign prostatic hyperplasia. And I should say that even though it sounds like we're really shutting down the gland, people shouldn't think of this as a cure or a treatment for prostate cancer because we never completely kill all the tissue. And a lot of the outer shell of the gland really remains alive, and that's where most prostate cancers show up. So people should still undergo, you know, their age-appropriate prostate cancer screening.
Right.
But now, you know, in the same, kind of along the same lines of doing minimally invasive procedures, now we have kind of moved into treating prostate cancer as well. And so now we do, it's an ultrasound guided MRI guided, what we call prostate ablation, where we actually use heat to cook or burn the prostate tissue. And this is also an outpatient procedure. And there's really literally no incision because we just put this device through the urethra. This is under general anesthesia. And we'll actually use MRI guidance to kind of treat the entire prostate gland and then take the device out and patients go home the same day.
Oh, wow.
They should have a catheter in for a week or two. But so that's a new treatment for prostate cancer. And we also do MRI-guided prostate biopsies. So we're really doing a lot of new, interesting image-guided ways to kind of treat prostate disease. The biopsies themselves, typically urologists will go through the rectum. And so there's possible issues with not targeting the area that we need to target properly, but also there's an infection risk that goes with going through the rectum. But the way we do it, we go through the skin, not the rectum, and with a small needle. So the infection risk is much lower. And so there's lots of things we can do less and less invasively these days that really can kind of treat prostate disease with fewer risks and fewer side effects than before.
That's definitely a subject for another day to explore more deeply. That's fantastic. Yeah. By the way, insurance?
Oh, yeah. So the embolization procedure, it's approved by the FDA. And so any patient on Medicare, it'll cover it, no problem. So the American Urological Association guidelines, they still, unfortunately, describe the embolization procedure as experimental because they still insist on, you know, they want to have like the longer term, like I said, the 10-year data out there before they will decide to say it's not experimental, which you can disagree or agree with that. But a lot of the insurance companies will then use those guidelines as their kind of dictate the parameters of what they'll cover, what they won't cover. So the under 65 patients with private insurances will have trouble getting it paid for unless there's, you know, significant bleeding, in which case we do the embolization to kind of treat the bleeding rather than treating BPH. But it's there's a small number of patients who with BPH bad enough to treat that aren't on Medicare. Some of the Medicare Advantage plans will administer their benefits kind of using the same kind of policy limitations that they'll use for their private insurance products as well. So sometimes we have to do some finagling with, if a patient really wants the procedure, we'll kind of switch them from their Medicare Advantage plan to their, you know, regular Medicare if they want. It's not an issue most of the time. In terms of the biopsies, that's any biopsy gets covered by insurance. That's no problem. Yeah. And then for the ablation, that's pretty new. That's right now it's about half of it is covered by insurance. And so the out-of-pocket expense can end up being, you know, anywhere from, you know, $8,000 to $12,000 probably. But I think within a year, we'll hopefully have that figured out better. And in the meantime, at least there are lots of, unfortunately these days, lots of plans out there where the co-pays and deductibles are so high anyway that whether it's $6,000 or $8,000 or $10,000, unfortunately ends up not being too big of a difference. So we have patients who are just saying, well, I'll pay a few extra $1,000 because I want to have this done.
You've been fantastic. And I'm sorry I took so much of your time. Thank you so much.
I love talking about it.
Oh, your passion is contagious.